That's right. All right, Esther chapter 9. We'll look at this morning the first 19. I said this morning, it's evening. This evening, I don't have editing software, so that is now going to be on sermon audio for perpetuity. Esther chapter 9, verses 1 to 19. Now in the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, on the 13th day of the same, when the king's command and edict were about to be carried out, on the very day when the enemies of the Jews hoped to gain the mastery over them, the reverse occurred. The Jews gained mastery over those who hated them. The Jews gathered in their cities throughout all the provinces of King Ahasuerus to lay hands on those who sought their harm, and no one could stand against them, for the fear of them had fallen on all peoples. All the officials of the provinces and the satraps and the governors and the royal agents also helped the Jews, for the fear of Mordecai had fallen on them. For Mordecai was great in the king's house, and his fame spread throughout all the provinces, for the man Mordecai grew more and more powerful. The Jews struck all their enemies with the sword, killing and destroying them, and did as they pleased to those who hated them. In Susa, the citadel itself, the Jews killed and destroyed 500 men, and also killed Parshandatha, and Dalphon, and Aspatha, and Poratha, and Adalea, and Aradatha, and Parmashta, and Arisai, and Aradai, and Vezatha, the 10 sons of Haman, the son of Hamadatha, the enemy of the Jews. But they laid no hand on the plunder. That very day, the number of those killed in Susa, the citadel, was reported to the king. And the king said to Queen Esther, "In Susa, the citadel, the Jews have killed and destroyed 500 men, and also the 10 sons of Haman. What then have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? Now what is your wish? It shall be granted you. And what further is your request? It shall be fulfilled." And Esther said, "If it please the king, let the Jews who are in Susa be allowed tomorrow also to do according to this day's edict. And let the 10 sons of Haman be hanged on the gallows." So the king commanded this to be done. A decree was issued in Susa, and the 10 sons of Haman were hanged. The Jews who were in Susa gathered also on the 14th day of the month of Adar, and they killed 300 men in Susa, but they laid no hands on the plunder. Now the rest of the Jews who were in the king's provinces also gathered to defend their lives and got relief from their enemies and killed 75,000 of those who hated them, but they laid no hands on the plunder. This was on the 13th day of the month of Adar, and on the 14th day they rested and made that a day of feasting and gladness. But the Jews who were in Susa gathered on the 13th day and on the 14th day and rested on the 15th day, making that a day of feasting and gladness. Therefore, the Jews of the villages who live in the rural towns hold the 14th day of the month of Adar as a day for gladness and feasting, as a holiday, and as a day on which they send gifts of food to one another. A wrap-up story. Now, notice that what we've got here is from chapter 8 to chapter 9, a jump in time again. Right? We were in the third month, where the decree was, we'll say for practical purposes, the decree was essentially reversed, even though itself it was not revoked. A counter decree went out to basically, in effect, reverse the effects of the first decree. Because, as the king himself said to Esther and to Mordecai, hey, once the king's edict has gone out, it can't be revoked. So we've had some time go by, and in fact, now we come to the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, on the 13th day of the same. Now, why is that date so significant? This one's a gimme.
It was the day the edict was supposed to happen?
Yeah, it was the day that the edict, the initial one that Haman had written up, this was the day. 8 months have passed. It's now time. Except there's a new edict alongside of it. And so we've got the date. The date comes. And it's really interesting because, you know, as you read this, there's almost a certain anticlimactic sense to this. Because really, the tension came when Esther had to finally confront Haman. That's really where the story is. Because now we go to chapter 9, and it's like, yeah, okay. You know, you knew this was going to happen. You just knew it. This almost seems anticlimactic. And so here it is, 12th month, end of the year, 13th day, and the king's command and edict were about to be carried out. And the enemies of the Jews hoped to gain the mastery over them, but the reverse occurred. The Jews gained mastery over those who hated them. And verse 2 gives a description. All of the cities throughout the provinces of the king, they gathered. And they sought to lay hands on those who sought them harm, and no one could stand against them. And note the reason. For the fear of them had fallen on all peoples. 8 months later, you know, that's enough time to start letting the stories manifest themselves throughout the regions. You know, granted, they had no internet, and they probably had some of their own conspiracy theories, no doubt. But at the end of the day, we see that all of a sudden, everybody's afraid of the Jews, and they're not even the one who's in control of the empire, are they? Now, I don't know of a time in history, and I'm no historian, I don't know of a time in history when a subject people under some kind of foreign oppression, like we have here with the Persians, but a subject people was actually the object of fear. Anybody else know of a situation like that? We've got a historian back here. Do you know of a case like that where a subject people were actually an object of fear?
I would say in the early 1930s, late 1920s, on the island of Taiwan, then Formosa under Japanese control, the indigenous peoples revolted against the Japanese. But in the end, it was no consequence because all the peoples, modern warfare overcame them, but the Japanese were afraid of them. So that's the closest thing that they do.
Okay. So there's an example. They were afraid, but ultimately the technology of Japan overcame.
And they also committed mass suicide for that.
Yeah, well, that doesn't help either.
You've also got Israel and Egypt.
Israel and Egypt,
at the time of the end, before the Exodus, they were feared.
Yeah.
And that was half the reason they were put in bondage.
Yeah. There was a bit of a fear that came about because of the speed with which they were multiplying.
Our own colonists fought the British. I
mean, yeah. They did, but the British really didn't think that they were all that tough. And
that was a problem.
Yeah, that was a problem. And, you know, the Bill Cosby sketch about, you know, they flip the coin and, all right, and the colonists win, so they get to hide behind the trees, and the British, they have to wear red coats and stand in formation. You know, that kind of thing. yeah, I probably just went off the rails on that one. But, you know, it's those kind of things. The British really didn't think much of it. But it just was remarkable how it came about. They just really threw up their hands in many respects. But here we've got an entire empire of people that are fearing the Jews. Much the same way that the Egyptians, way back in the day, feared the growth of the nation of Israel. But now we've got this subject people that everybody else is afraid of. And we get further reasons here. And notice what happens here in verse 3. all the officials of the provinces and the satraps and the governors and the royal agents also helped the Jews, for the fear of Mordecai had fallen on them. Now think about this for a moment. You're a governor, you're an official in some other province, and you have these two edicts in your hand. Just looking at those two edicts, what are you going to be thinking? What am I supposed to do here? I've got this one that says the Jews are supposed to be killed, destroyed, and annihilated. But then I've got this other one here that says the Jews can defend themselves and destroy, kill, and annihilate all their enemies. You know, if you just look at that by itself, we'll take Mordecai out of the picture for a moment. That has got to be a bit of confusing mixed messages, such as life under a big government usually. But you've got these conflicting edicts, and I can't imagine that this was anything but confusing to them. But what tipped the scales is what the author here indicates, is that the fear of Mordecai had fallen on them. That's what tipped the scales. And all of these officials and governors could have rightfully, I think, could have rightly chosen one side or the other. And you really could have had some kind of nasty civil war. But we're told by the author they chose the Jews because they feared Mordecai.
That's very bizarre. I mean, Haman deserved being feared, not Mordecai.
Yeah.
But the stories twisted themselves around.
So no doubt.
He's fearing Mordecai, and he's not the man who needs to be feared.
Yeah. There's no indication that the people ever feared Haman. That's the interesting thing. You don't really see that the people in the provinces, but they do fear Mordecai. Now, whether or not this is sort of a terrifying fear because the stories got out of control, which is certainly plausible, or whether it is that respectful fear, you know, the author doesn't really define that for us. It's just there.
Mordecai is pretty much in the position of Joseph in Egypt.
That's right. That's exactly right.
So, and all of Egypt highly respected Joseph.
They certainly did.
Providentially, Mordecai had been paraded through.
Yep, through Susa, right. So certainly news of that took place.
By
Haman.
Who's now dead.
Who's now hanging on the gallows.
Right.
Along with his 10 sons, which we'll get to in a bit. But what were you going to say, Michael?
Well, Haman really didn't want to kill anybody but the Jews, so why be afraid of him? He just wants to annihilate the Jews, not us.
Well, I mean, that's possible, but it certainly, at the very least, caused plenty of confusion when he introduced his edict, and certainly did in the city of Susa. And now we see in verse 4, we see the promotion here. For Mordecai was great in the king's house, and his fame spread throughout all the provinces, for the man Mordecai grew more and more powerful in 8 months. Didn't take much. And of course, if you think about it, that kind of makes sense. Within only a couple of months, we went from Haman having the signet ring to Mordecai having the signet ring. Basically, the blank check. Able to issue any command he wanted. And now we've got Mordecai growing in his fame that spreads through all the provinces, and he grew more and more powerful. Well, the two go hand in hand. And not only that, for him to grow more and more powerful, the king had to have allowed this to happen. So there is, I think, in here a very implied message that, like Joseph, Mordecai was well respected by the king. Mordecai saved his life. So...
also, compared to Haman, Mordecai is kind of more intelligent. You know, Haman is portrayed as being very unintelligent. The people might have known that, and so...
yeah, certainly in the city of Susa, I'm sure they knew that.
He'd also been in sackcloth in public.
Yeah.
His spiritual fervor.
And the strength of his convictions.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, no question. And so he grows more and more powerful, and as a result of all of this, it's almost like verses, verse 4 is somewhat parenthetical, but we can come back to the story in verse 5. The Jews struck all their enemies with the sword, killing and destroying them. Now, there's a word missing there.
Annihilate.
Honestly, I don't know why. None of the commentators that I've read really make an indication. Because both decrees used to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate. And you would kind of think here, you would see that as well. But no, we don't. And I don't know why. I really don't.
That's because of that clash thing, they kind of didn't want to add that extra emphasis. There's kind of like a big clash between the Jews and the ones against the Jews. So kind of felt like it wasn't really needed.
That may be possible. But of course, you know, they're all synonyms anyway. You know, destroy and kill. Well, yeah, they are annihilated.
Well, it says all.
Yeah, all.
So that may infer that.
Yep. So they're all killed with the sword. They're able to take up arms. And then in verse 6, we get to the city of Susa itself. The Jews killed and destroyed 500 men. And then we get the listing of the names of the sons of Haman.
That legal thing again.
Yeah, it's got that legal flair to it. You know, somebody had access to the records and knew who these men were. And, you know, we don't see any of their names until here. Imagine, you're inscripturated in God's word and your only mention is the fact that you were killed and hung on gallows. That's quite a lasting testimony, I guess.
Dubious distinction.
Yeah, very dubious distinction.
Sins of the Father.
Sins of the Father, that's right. So the 10 sons of Haman, enemies of the Jews. And notice this language that's done here at the end of verse 10. But they laid no hand on the plunder. Now this occurs two other times in this same section. Anybody want to venture a guess as to why that's significant? Saul did it. And that's what ultimately created the whole mess in the first place. Saul was supposed to kill, destroy, and annihilate all the Amalekites. And who was the king of the Amalekites? Agag. Haman, the Agagite. And what we see unfolding here, I think, is a strong connection that now the Jews are doing precisely what God commanded the Israelites to do way back in Saul's day. Don't touch the plunder.
They're also following the godly example of Abraham, who did not take the plunder from the king of Sodom.
That's right. Lest, you remember what his argument was? Abraham gave the argument.
Yes, lest they say that the king of Sodom made Abraham
rich. Right. And so here we've got a very similar thing, following that godly example.
And theme of obedience again.
Yeah, there's a sense of obedience. And it's not because in and of itself, they probably had the right to take the plunder.
Yeah.
Well, verse 11, chapter 8.
Yeah.
The edict said they could.
The very last line.
Yeah, they could, but they didn't.
Right. It also relates back to Jericho and Joshua.
Yeah, same idea. Same thing happened. And the thing about that is, and you think of Achan's sin, and he takes it, and he, you know, they cast lots, and they whittle it down to his family. What's that? Yeah, God knows. And he and his family are killed because of his sin. And had Achan just simply waited till the very next city, they were commanded that they may take whatever spoils they wanted. And there's an example of in a sense, in that example, it's a bit of a tangent, but it's related, that the first fruits belong to the Lord. You ever think about that? That's what the story, part of the story of Jericho, and the reason why all those things were not to be plundered. The first fruits belonged to the Lord. And the next city, once they got straightened out and repented and took care of Achan and his family, the Lord blessed them by letting them take the plunder. But here, we've got an interesting thing take place, because three times it's mentioned in our passage, they did not take the plunder from anyone. And so that godly example there is set. And so moving on, then we see that very day the number of those killed in Susa, the citadel, was reported to the king. And so now the king goes to Queen Esther. In Susa, the citadel, the Jews have killed and destroyed 500 men and also the 10 sons of Haman. What then have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? You see, that's a statement there by the king, that's like, wow, they did this much here in Susa. What's going on in the rest of the provinces? Well, we know from a little bit further down in verse 16, 75,000. That's a pretty significant number. And a lot of biblical critics will look at that and say, you know, I can't imagine that a king would ever allow that many of his citizens to be killed at once. Really? I mean, there are modern examples that were far worse than this. And it just makes no sense when these critics come up with these ideas out of their head, and it just makes no sense.
He was going to kill all the Jews anyway.
He was going to let the Jews be killed anyway. I mean, all throughout history, oppressive rulers had no problems killing thousands upon thousands of subjects. Even millions in more modern days. Stalin with his 20 million in Russia, in the Leningrad area in particular. You know, of course, we think Hitler. What's that? Pol Pot. You know, and those are the modern ones. So there's this certain sense that the king is like, wow, if they've done this, I wonder what they've done in the rest of the king's provinces. And now comes something that we've seen before. Now, what is your wish? It shall be granted you. And what further is your request? It shall be fulfilled. That's what set up all the feasts. Remember? 8 months ago, Esther comes in, has the scepter extended to her. And the king utters almost these exact words. This time he doesn't offer half the kingdom. You might be able to argue that it's implied, but you're right. He doesn't offer it. But it is very similar poetic type language, the parallelism that takes place again. But this time it's interesting because you remember we talked about some of the cultural things that go on in the Middle East, that even some of those cultural things are still there today. That you make the you offer... and you don't say anything. They offer again, you don't say anything. But the third time, that's when you do it. Well, Esther doesn't wait this time. She just comes right out with it. In verse 13, if it please the king, let the Jews who are in Susa be allowed tomorrow also to do according to this day's edict. And let the 10 sons of Haman be hanged on the gallows. Now, there's a lot of modern-day evangelicalism that love to put examples, Bible examples, characters in the Bible that are set forth that to be examples for us. You know, be like Joseph, be like David, be like Abraham, blah, 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 blah. And yet you read the stories of some of these individuals and you realize, yeah, there's some things I really don't want to emulate in these people.
Yep.
Here's an example. You know, you see books out there, Women of the Bible, and how we should respect them and so forth. I suppose if there was one woman of the Bible that you would follow, probably Dinah would be good to judge. Deborah, sorry. Not Dinah.
Dinah's the chef.
Yeah, right. Deborah.
You should have made real coffee.
That's right. Deborah, the judge. So she would be an example, that one. But Esther, I mean, look at this story and what she's asking for here. Well, I don't know. You know, that's the interesting thing. Because the 10 sons are already dead. You know, they're already dead. And what she is asking for is actually something that is condemned by the Old Testament.
I forgot that.
You know, when somebody is hanged according to Old Testament law, you had to take them down by sunset. These guys are already dead, and the next day she wants them hung up on the gallows. That's a pretty bloodthirsty type of attitude.
Maybe she wants more fear for Mordecai.
That could be. That may be the case. Or more fear for herself. I don't know. But you notice, again, it's another one of these situations. You read of this, even from our own perspective, and granted, we're in the 21st century, and you scratch your head and you wonder about this, the morality of what she's doing, yet the author just mentions it and passes by it with no judgment whatsoever. You know, once again, showing us that Mordecai and Esther in particular are presented to us as just simply morally neutral. No judgment is made on any of their actions. Their actions are just described. And it's a reminder to us, it's not an excuse for us, but it is a reminder to us that the Lord will use even improper and impure motives for his purposes. It's not an excuse for us to have impure purposes and motives and say, well, hey, it's part of God's plan. We can do whatever we want. No. But because God is so sovereign and in so much control that he will use the impure motives of other individuals, even his own people.
It's not brushed under the rug. It's in Scripture.
Yeah, it's not brushed under the rug. It's presented.
It's part of purpose.
Yep. Yeah, it's not whitewashed in any sense. It's no judgment is passed, but it's not glossed over either. So she's asking that the king or Haman's sons be hung up on the gallows. Remember, they're about 75 feet tall on top of his own house, which is now Esther's house. Isn't that interesting? Well, I'm assuming these gallows are the same ones. They don't necessarily have to be, but I would assume that they are.
Would they have been perpendicular?
I don't know. That's a good question. And the thing about this is, you know, we talked about this. We talked about this back with respect to when Haman was building them in the first place. That these were probably the precursors to the Roman crucifixion, and so that they were. The translation is hung on the gallows, but probably a better translation is that they were impaled on them. So, so she's not exactly shy, and it's not any indication that she's one to flinch at the sight of a spider, so to speak. So, there you have it. My suggestion is, at least in this case, don't try to emulate Esther. And so it ends up happening. The king responds. So the king commanded this to be done. A decree was issued in Susa, and the 10 sons of Haman were hanged. The Jews who were in Susa gathered also on the 14th day of the month of Adar, and they killed 300 men in Susa. But they laid no hands on the plunder. Again. Then we get to the rest of the empire. We see there the 75,000 of those who hated them. They are killed. And again, verse 16. But they laid no hands on the plunder. And then we start to get a description of what takes place and how the feasting is all set up. And this is really a precursor to the rest of chapter 9. Which describes in much more detail the inauguration or the start of the Feast of Purim. OK. right? So what ends up happening is the Jews in Susa, they gathered on the 13th and 14th day and rested on the 15th day. Whereas everybody else in the rural regions, they just gathered on the 13th day and rested on the 14th day. So if you lived in the city, you celebrated Purim on the 15th. If you lived out in the country, you celebrated on the 14th. You could have two celebrations, especially today, because you can drive in a car and go. Sounds like a plan, right? Yeah, that's right. But you notice, which by the way, the Feast of Purim was not technically a religious holiday. It is more of a civil holiday. But there's no doubt that there is, even though it's a civil holiday, an understanding that God's hand was behind all of this. You know, you can't read the book of Esther as a Christian and read through this and say, coincidence. This is God's hand throughout. And then also, it's interesting, I think, well, I won't say this for certain, but when you look at our own confession of faith, and you have, I've got to find the right chapter, it's toward the back. Not quite the back, but near the back. Chapter 21, it's on page 860. Of religious worship in the Sabbath day. Paragraph 5 describes the ordinary things that are to go in worship. Okay? The reading of the scriptures with godly fear, the sound preaching and conscionable hearing of the word in obedience unto God with understanding, faith, and reverence, singing of psalms with grace in the heart, as also the due administration and worthy receiving of the sacraments instituted by Christ, are all parts of the ordinary religious worship of God. Beside religious oaths, vows, solemn fastings, thanksgivings upon special occasions, which are in their several times and seasons to be used in an holy and religious manner. I think you can make the argument that the confession does allow for special times of gathering to celebrate God's goodness. I think if anything, you know, having a Thanksgiving Day service is a wonderful idea. I'm not saying we should automatically have one, but I have no objection to it. And, you know, there are a lot of people that will use that part of the confession and also the story of Esther in particular to point to reasons why they might have a Thanksgiving Day service or a Good Friday service or a Christmas Eve service. Well, the session of a given church does have the right on special occasions to call the people to worship. They cannot bind their conscience beyond what the Lord's Day requires, so that if somebody says, yeah, I don't feel like going tonight, because, you know, it's one of those special occasion worship services, that's fine. Now, this just simply to show that the Lord works in such remarkable ways, even throughout the history of everything that's going on. We look at the book of Esther, we don't see God's name mentioned once, yet his hand is so obviously there. Look at the events even in just this past week in the world. What's happening over in the Ukraine currently? What just happened in the Ukraine? You know, we see these atrocities that take place, which, you know,
we've got about 15 different stories that are going on, so nobody really knows what the truth is. But at the end of the day, do we as Christians trust that our God reigns supreme? That he will carry out his redemptive purposes for the sake of the church and to his glory. Christ is not up there wringing his hands. Oh, I never saw that one coming. There is nothing that happens in this world that is outside of his control, whether they are because of the hands of men or what we call so-called natural disasters. All things, God's works of providence are his most holy, wise, and powerful, preserving and governing all his creatures. That doesn't necessarily mean living things. Everything that's created is a creature, and all their actions. God's in control. That's the thing that Esther ought to remind us of. And that he will care for his people in every circumstance. And should he, in his wisdom, decide that it's time for the sake of the church to take us home, that's his choice, and it will bring him glory. You know, a pastor friend of mine posted on Facebook today that his aged grandfather just went home to be the Lord. And, you know, you say to him, and I posted this on, commented under his, and I said, you know, sorry for your loss, but rejoicing that he is at the feet of the Savior. Because that was part of God's plan. And it brings him glory. And so does the story of Esther. It brings him glory in a most remarkable way. Any other thoughts or comments? Say it wasn't that short.
The two agents, then there was confusion. There was calls to prayer.
Yeah.
And obedience.
Yeah. There was certainly a call to fast.
Yeah.
You probably could assume prayer was involved for at least some of them.
We should be praying.
We most certainly should be praying. Yes?
Does it say how many Jews were killed? Did I miss that?
Doesn't say at all that any were killed. Could have some been killed? Sure. The text says nothing about any Jews being killed.
There's a little area where it says, and Mordecai wrote this.
Verse 20, is it?
Mordecai recorded these events, and I think there was another area too. But they don't think Mordecai wrote this, that he just may have recorded some of those.
There are some that think that Mordecai may have written Esther, but others also think that it's possible that they had Mordecai's records and other records of you know, the annals of the king, so to speak. Because whoever wrote it seemed to have a lot of detailed information. They seemed to know the inner workings and the inner structure of the very palace of the king. So, either through Mordecai's writings and other writings, you know, the very chronicles that the king had read to him when he couldn't sleep, for instance. So, the author had very clear access to something to give him all these details. So either it was Mordecai or somebody who followed right on his heels.
The servants were in the know.
It's not impossible. Maybe one of the servants wrote it. I doubt it, but you never know.
They were used to communicate.
Yeah. So. All right. Well, next week we'll look at the Feast of Purim in a little bit more detail. And I'm actually hoping to discover some Jewish customs, even modern day ones.
Check on that.
You know what? That's a good idea.
Summer homework.
Look at that. Summer homework. See? Spoken like a teacher. I think you kids ought to look for information about the Feast of Purim. Yeah, teach us all. Teach us all some stuff. Some customs and what did the Jews do to celebrate? Like, We different families do different things on Thanksgiving, for instance. You know, or Christmas or Easter or whatever the case may be. What do Jews do on the Feast of Purim? What do they eat?
Okay.
Turkey.
Well, they don't eat pork. We know that.
Yeah.
So, all right. So, you guys think you can do that for next week? Yeah? Yeah, I think we can do that. They are. I'm like, are you kidding? School's out. No.
It's summer.
Suddenly, everybody's going to have the sniffles next week. That's what's going to happen. That's right. There won't be any kids here. So I better make sure I'm prepared. All right. Why don't we close in prayer then?